Hi, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to 96.3 FM, and welcome back to Travel Notes, a monthly radio show and podcast where we use music as a medium to explore ways in which we're all connected. You can stay in touch and learn more about today's show and past episodes on my website, gracemcnallymusic.com, under the Travel Notes tab. Today's conversation was really fun because our guest is extremely knowledgeable not only of her craft as a musician, but also has a wealth of knowledge from her research. Our guest today is Laura Risk. She's an assistant professor in the Music and Culture Program of the Department of Arts, Culture, and Media at the University of Toronto Scarborough. She's also a professional fiddler. Laura's fiddling has been described by filmmaker Ken Burns as a revelation and achingly beautiful. She's based in Montreal, Canada, where she performs and teaches Scottish and Quebecois fiddling. Today, we dive into a few of her research projects and explore tunes and musical traditions that are hundreds of years old and have relations to music traditions from all over the globe. We also listen to a few songs off her newest album, Traverse, which was released in 2023 and is a 10-track musical journey through traditional fiddle music. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Okay, Laura, welcome to Travel Notes.
Good to be here.
So excited to have you on the show. And I thought to kind of give listeners an idea of the music that you specialize in and research, I'd love to start with your project on Douglastown. Tell me a little bit about the place that this takes place, the music comes from, and what drew you to this particular project.
Douglastown is a small village on the Gaspé Peninsula in Quebec. And I live in Montreal. Douglastown is, if you're lucky, maybe a 12-hour drive. So it's quite far. You go all the way up to St. Lawrence to where it meets the Atlantic Ocean. Douglastown is just, I think, about 20 kilometers south of the main town or city in that area, which is Gaspé. I first went to Douglastown in 2010. I was invited to play at a summertime festival they had there called Irish Week, which gives you a little bit of a sense of Douglastown just by knowing that they had a festival called Irish Week in Quebec, in the Gaspé Peninsula. The Gaspé historically has been fairly linguistically mixed area. So Quebec is a primarily French-speaking province of Canada. But there are certain areas that have historically had more English settlement. And Douglastown was a primarily Anglophone community. Now I'd say it's more mixed, Francophone and Anglophone, but that's just in the recent decades. So I went up, I'm a fiddler, and I went to play at Irish Week, but I also went because, or I should say that when I was there, I was fortunate enough to become involved in a project that the community center of the village was just launching. They wanted to do an oral history project that would document an older culture of music and song and dance that had been very, very strong in the village and that had, I wouldn't say had died out, but was not as strong at the time. So it was a privilege. It was an honor and a privilege to be invited by a small community to work with them on a project to document their local musical history. And I ended up co-producing a CD of archival recordings from Douglastown and also from some of the nearby communities. It's a CD that we always thought of it as like a musical portrait of the town. So there's fiddling, there's singing, there's a range of repertoire. So there's what we might think of as like folk or traditional repertoire, but there's country songs. People, you know, picking tunes on the guitar. Like it's just giving you a sense of musically a very vibrant life that was a part of that community and really that has continued to be there or has evolved. I should say one other thing about the recordings on this, on that CD and on that project. Douglastown was n it was these are what I think of as archival recordings. They're older recordings. They're not commercial. They were not made it for as commercial recordings. None of them were made in studios. They were made in people's homes, at their house parties, at their holiday parties, or when neighbors went to visit other neighbors. But they weren't made with the goal of putting them in an archive somewhere. This wasn't somebody from the outside, like a folklorist, coming in and saying, "I want to document your music and I'm going to take it to the museum." It was people in the community documenting themselves and each other for themselves. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that, well, some of it had to do with the fact that there was exciting new technologies like portable reel-to-reel machines. And there were then cassette players, cassette recorders. So there were some people who were at the cutting edge of those technologies. Like there are a couple of folks in town who got reel-to-reel, portable reel-to-reel recorders, one in the late 50s, early 60s, and recorded the way we might with our iPhones now. We might say, "Oh, that's, I'm gonna take a video of that," or "That's interesting." Like they were doing that with reel-to-reel. It's like, "I like the sound of that. I'm gonna put it on my reel." But there was also, because the economics of day-to-day life were sometimes challenging. It was a community that was a lot, there was a lot of subsistence farming. There was fishing, there was mining, there was lumber in the winter. And a lot of those industries went through some hard times. And so there was out-migration in the village. And one way that people kept in touch is they would send recordings. They would make recordings of themselves or of their parties and send those to somebody who'd moved away. And there's this kind of back and forth of cassette tapes to people who lived in the Montreal area or had moved to the States or in Vancouver. And then people would also take these tapes. Once they were on the cassette technologies, they would take these tapes and make mixtapes of the best of their neighbors. So
I
this is what
love
we were working
that.
with. It
That's so creative.
was a yeah, it was an amazing set of musical materials to have it be able to digitize and then select from that for the CD, and materials that carried a lot of emotional meaning, of course,
Sure.
because this wasn't just a recording of a fiddle tune. It was a recording of, your aunt playing that fiddle tune, or it was a recording of your father, or it was a recording of your neighbor. So it carried a lot more than just the music, people in the town.
Sure. That's really cool. That's really what a special way to share the music, with the outside world. Where do you think this music in Douglastown originated from, like its roots, where it came from originally?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question for all fiddle music.
Right.
There was a great folklorist in the States named Alan Jabbour. He worked with Smithsonian Folkways for a while, and he has this phrase that I always come back to. He was thinking more about fiddle music in the United States. But if we think about all of these traditions that we can hear are related. So we might think about British Isles traditions like Scottish or Irish or English. We might think about North American traditions, including New England fiddle traditions or more Southern Appalachian traditions in the States. And there's traditions in Quebec, there's Acadian traditions, there's traditions in the Maritimes, well, Acadian also in Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia, all over. I mean, this is just a handful of all the fiddling traditions that I could name. And Alan Jabbour used to call those cultural cousins. with the idea that they were of the same generation, which is or relatively close. And that generation goes was born, I guess, if we want to continue the metaphor, in the late 18th century. There was a shift in the type of dancing that people were interested in and that was popular. And then there's a corresponding shift in music. This is like I'm giving you the very
Oh, I love it.
the very general overview here, but there was kind of a craze for a form of dancing called country dancing. There was type of repertoire that's associated with that. Then over the 19th century, there are other forms of dancing that became popular. There were quadrilles, there were later waltzes. So there's this is a dance music that it was a very functional music in the sense that it was what you played for certain types of dancing. And those dances and those tunes and then new versions of those tunes and then and new tunes, new dances evolved in all of these places, partly independently, but also in contact with each other. There was a lot of movement, a lot of back and forth. There were dancing masters who were traveling around teaching dances. There were books of dances and of sheet music for those who could read. Musicians, of course, traveled. So there's this kind of back and forth and exchange. And then we get into the 20th century. There's also connections through radio and recordings. It's a lot of new technologies that are transmitting the tunes. And all of this is creating this kind of cultural or musical mix where you have some elements of tunes might feel like another tradition. You might say, oh, like that sounds a little bit Irish, or that sounds a little bit American, or I've heard that tune played by this other fiddler. But then there's also a local sense. This is back to the cousin metaphor of like everybody grows up a little bit differently, everyone looks a little different. And even though you see that you can see the similarities. So in Douglastown, there were all kinds of influences. There was a in terms of settlement, there were actually loyalists who came up to the United States. That was some of the first
Interesting.
English-speaking settlers in the area. There was, of course, a Mi'kmaq native. It was the native. It is the native population in that area. So the
Interesting.
Mi'kmaq nation. There's Irish, Scottish. It's connected to the Jersey fishing trade also. So there's this kind of back and forth.
Wow.
I'm sure there was music traveling with those people. And at the same time, music was coming in, as I said, from new technologies. So somewhere out of all of this, we get this distinctive repertoire and sound, which still, when you hear it, still feels connected to Acadian fiddling, which is just over the bay in New Brunswick, and another fiddling on the Gaspé, up on the Gaspé Peninsula in other communities. You can hear the musical connections for sure.
Wow, that's so fascinating. And I really had no idea that it was like I didn't put it together that it would be connected to dance so strongly. And that was actually influencing, it
Yeah.
sounds like, yeah, the trajectory.
It's this, what we think of as fiddle music. Well, I shouldn't, maybe I won't say what we think of, but what is fiddle music today? What we hear and what you might go to a concert to hear or at a festival, was the music that was played for popular dancing, popular forms of popular dances all through the 19th century into the 20th. So the idea that you might just listen to this music is actually relatively recent. It's a very, as I said, a very functional music.
Yeah, cool. And so this project resulted in this album of archival recordings. Would love to play one of those here. And it's cool. I love that you suggested doing, we'll play this version of this song in its archival format, and then at the end, play your recording off your new album, which we'll talk about as well, the same song, in very folk music fashion. And so tell me a little bit about this recording, Charlie's Droughty, and who recorded in all the good stuff.
Yeah. Charlie Droughty was a fiddler from Douglastown. He was born in 1888. And he worked as fisherman, commercial fisherman, and also as a fire ranger. And I never got to know him. He passed away in 1971, but I did know his son, Ernest Droughty, fairly well. Ernest was a wonderful fiddler from Douglastown who I got to know the first time I went up and spent time with. Every other time I was in Douglastown, I would always spend some time with Ernest. We'd play tunes, and Ernest unfortunately just passed away last year. But the fiddling was really strong in the Droughty family, and Charlie and his brother Joe were just celebrated local fiddlers. They would play for dances regularly. They were Ernest used to tell me this story about how back in the day, I think this would be like maybe the 1950s or 40s, actually probably maybe even earlier, maybe 30s and 40s, when the young people in the village would go out to neighboring villages for the dance, and then the dance would end, but they would want to dance more. They would come back to Douglastown, and they would go to a fiddler's home like Charlie Droughty's, knock on the door at, 2 in the morning or something, wake up the fiddler, have him come down into his own kitchen and have
Oh,
him play for a square set. It's like eight dancers
I
in
love
his
it.
own kitchen at 2 in the morning. And then this group of young folk would go on to the next fiddler's house and do the same thing. This is what they would do all night. So that was Charlie Droughty. That was, he was a well-known fiddler in the Douglastown community. And we are very lucky to have, I think we have a total of three recordings of his playing. And this is one of them. He didn't have a name for this tune. There's versions, other versions of this tune that you hear from other fiddlers in the Gaspé, but yeah, I think he has a really distinctive sound and approach to playing the tune.
What barriers did the music, traditional folk music, in Douglastown come up against?
I think one thing that happened in Douglastown that has happened in many communities is that this is a music that often takes place in certain types of social contexts, and when those contexts are not there or are less present, then there's fewer opportunities for the music. So, for instance, dancing, and having these regular dances. There wasn't a regular dance in Douglastown, but there were plenty in the neighboring villages, and people would go and go to those, and the music was also played for weddings, family parties, and when that changes, when people decide to play other types of music, or they do less dancing, or that they do other forms of dancing, or they move away, that the social opportunities to play the music change, I guess. I've heard some folks say, when television came in, stop learning to play the tunes. This is what people did in the evenings often, to at the end of a long day of work, is they'd go over to the local fiddler's house and listen to them play a few tunes. Maybe they do a bit of dancing, or they'd sing some songs together. And if when you replace that with some other form of entertainment, it doesn't get passed on in the same way. So there's definitely a kind of a generational split. Like, you can see that there was a generation where people just didn't learn how to play the fiddle as much as they had in previous generations, or sing those songs. And I don't know if we can blame it all on television, but I think there was this shift in how we understand entertainment as something that we do ourselves versus something that's done to us or provided to us.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. It honestly makes a lot of sense. What motivates you as a researcher to study and preserve folk music?
Well, I love it. I love the music. I play it. I'm fascinated by tunes. I love a good tune. So there's that. Also, there is preservation for sure, but preservation goes hand in hand with transmission. And I'm not actually that interested in just preserving for the sake of preserving. Like, if the job were to digitize old recordings and then put them on a shelf somewhere, I don't think I would be so excited by that. But what does excite me is a project where I'm working with people, with a community, and where the process of preservation is also a process of transmission, or of even more than that, like kind of building a kind of life and excitement around the music and what's connected to it. And that's something that I really got to see firsthand in Douglastown, where you can't just walk up to somebody who has a cassette tape of their father, and they don't know you, and you don't know them, and you can't just walk them and say, "Give me that cassette of your father. I'm going to go digitize it for you." I think the answer is no. Because it's meaningful, and it's like saying, "I'm going to give you my mother's wedding ring so you can go measure it or something." Yeah, it doesn't work like that. So a project like this was really about getting to know people in Douglastown and finding my way into those relationships and friendships through music. And I worked with a wonderful fiddler and ethnomusicologist named Glenn Patterson. We the two of us co-produced the CD, and we were also working with a great team at the community center. And a lot of the work we were doing was just hanging out with people, like going to somebody's house and playing music for them or with them if they played. And out of that came these conversations around what cassette tapes people might have and what we could do to make those recordings more useful to them. So when we digitized, for instance, we would always, of course, give back the originals, and then we would give back a digital copy. Some people no longer had cassette players. Actually, most people still had cassette players, but some people wanted to be able to play this music on CD too. So we could give them a CD of their cassette. One person I remember loved sharing this music with people at a local, like a retirement facility, and making mixtapes for them, but it was really hard to do that with the cassettes. So having it all on CDs, and they could make these
That's
compilation CDs. So it was like very practical, right? And
yeah.
people had plenty of ideas of how this music would useful and relevant to them. And we taught fiddle workshops, and we played for dancing, and like all of that goes hand in hand with this kind of research or preservation piece. And actually, when the CD came out, we did a release event. The local hall was packed. Everybody was there. It was amazing. It's a very small town. I think we must have had 400 people in this hall.
Wow.
And for days after, like you'd hear people driving down the street playing the CD in their car. And then a few years later, actually, some folks in Douglastown started up what they called the Douglastown Orchestra. Maybe it was the Douglastown Dance Orchestra. They started getting together and having kind of jam sessions and playing tunes and having dances, and that created a life of its own. I'm not going to take credit for that. I'm just going to say that these things, this is all part of traditional music. There's the preservation piece, but there's this transmission piece, and there's this like, what does this look like in day-to-day life? And all of
Yeah.
that, it just all goes together.
Totally. What a wonderful, it's like the gift that keeps on giving, like one thing
Yeah,
leads to
and
another.
a good one of those.
Yeah. I would love to talk about your music playing, your fiddle playing. Tell me a little bit about your musical journey and how you got started playing a fiddle.
I grew up in California, in San
Okay.
Francisco,
Cool.
and I started playing Suzuki violin, as sometimes you do when your parents decide to sign you up for Suzuki violin lessons. I think I was 7 or 8 at the time. I liked it. But I really got into fiddling when I was 13, 12 or 13, I think 13. A close friend of mine who was also taking Suzuki violin lessons had gone to there was a Scottish fiddle camp in the area, because there's a great Scottish fiddler named Alistair Fraser who had immigrated to California in the 80s, and then he'd started this Scottish local, what's called the San Francisco Scottish Fiddlers. It's like a fiddle club.
Cool.
The people who just get together usually once a month to play Scottish fiddle tunes for fun, and he also started this Scottish fiddle camp. My friend went to the camp as a babysitter. She was hired to go as a babysitter. And she had been taking some Irish fiddle lessons at the time because her parents were into that. She was young, she was like 10 or 11. And she went as a babysitter, loved the camp, took some classes there also, in addition to babysitting, brought me along the next year. I loved it. And that was kind of the beginning. So that's camp's called the Valley of the Moon Scottish Fiddling School. It still exists. I teach at it now, and I'm
Wow.
actually going to be there in 2 weeks. I'll be
Oh my
teaching there.
gosh. Full circle.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, I played. So I started out playing a lot of Scottish music. I'm not Scottish myself at all, but that was this scene that I fell into and really loved. And then I went to university in California at UC Berkeley, not in music. But after that, I moved to Boston and just decided I was going to try my hand at being a freelance fiddler.
Love it.
Which is, yeah, it's easier to do when you're in your early 20s. You don't have a lot of commitments, you don't have a lot of expenses. And yeah, that's kind of how it got going. Then I moved to Montreal in 2001 and been playing Quebecois music here and Scottish music ever since.
Very cool. Let's talk about your new album, Traverse. And did it come out last year? Was it or
Yeah,
two?
it came out last year.
2023.
Yeah.
It's a 10-track musical journey through traditional fiddle music. What inspired this album?
I'd been this album, it's a the band is a trio with Nicholas Williams on accordion, piano accordion and flute, and Rachel Auquin on piano. They're both people I'd played with for many years, not as a trio, but I'd ha actually had a duo with Nicholas and a duo with Rochelle for various different types of performances, including playing for some dancing, by the way, which is something I do sometimes and enjoy very much. And so there was a repertoire that had come out of these duos and a little bit of repertoire in common between the two duos. And for me, it felt like a repertoire that it ended up being, when I look back at it and look back at the set of tunes I was thinking about recording, I realized it was a very personal repertoire. It was a repertoire that to me felt a little bit like a recognition that I have reached a middle age in my life. I have children who are almost grown. At the time I had aging parents and the kind of all of the emotional ups and downs of that. And I found myself thinking a lot about the way that traditional music connects people across time and space, the way it connected me to earlier generations of fiddlers, the way it connected me to some older musicians like in Douglastown that I'd met who were themselves connected to fiddlers who'd been born in the 1800s. The way it connected me, the way I might write a tune for somebody, like I wrote some tunes for family members, and those created some kinds of connections that felt like they were able to go beyond words, which is often how we relate, is through talking. And I found myself thinking a lot about how music creates these other kinds of connections, and then this is where this idea of traverse came from, that we traverse time, we traverse space, and that when I'm playing traditional music, I think especially after having done it for many years, even a note or a gesture might evoke something else, some other person or another place or another tune. And there's something that I just really love about living in this musical world where I might play a note a certain way, and the person I'm playing with might recognize that I'm referring to this other player that we both know and love through just the inflection of the note. So that's kind of like the meta sense of traditional music that I guess I was coming at this album with. But then, yeah, on the very practical level, it was repertoire that I had been playing, especially with Nicholas and Rochelle and in different settings, and really wanted to record. And I was so excited, I have to say, about this trio. Like, I love these two duos, but the
Aw.
all of us coming together as a trio, I was just so excited about that. Nicholas and Rochelle know each other quite well and have played together themselves, so it was easy. It was just really easy musically to kind of find our sound.
So cool. I love that. I love when that happens. Well, let's dive in. I'd love to play First off the album, Jane Risk. Tell me a little bit about this tune.
This is a tune I wrote for my mom. And it's a little bit, it's the fiddle tunes tend to fall into certain types of tunes. There's like reels and jigs and so on. And I'm not really sure what this tune is. It doesn't quite fall into a category. I mean, and those categories are often dance types of dances, and some of them are types of listening tunes like slow airs. But this one, I don't know, it's a melody that came to me, and it's for my mother, who passed away in 2022, actually after we'd done the tracking on the album, and we were in the middle of mixing it. So she heard it. I didn't write it for her as a memorial or anything like that. I'd written it well before that, but it ended up being a bit of that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I can't wait to play it. This is Jane Risk off of Traverse. The next piece off the album is called, that I would like to talk about and play for everyone, is an homage us, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, so please correct me, homage us Stéphane Landry?
Yeah, Stéphane Landry. Stéphane Landry's, well, homage à Stéphane Landry means homage to Stéphane Landry, to a person named Stéphane Landry, who's an accordionist. And this is a tune that was written, actually this is two tunes, but I think I've just called the set that, but this is Hommage à Stéphane Landry and Hommage au Frère Pigeon, who were, Frère Pigeon translates to the Pigeon Brothers, or the Pigeon Brothers, like two brothers with that last name, who were well-known musicians, Montreal-based musicians, earlier in the 20th century. Both of these tunes are composed by Philippe Bruneau, who was a great accordionist from Quebec. He really transformed, I would say, kind of transformed like an understanding of what a single row button accordion can do. He just pushed the boundaries of what accordion tunes could sound like and what you could do with them technically. He was like a virtuoso player himself, and he wrote several hundred tunes, all of which are wonderful. Sometimes people write tunes, including myself, that are just not so good. I've written plenty of tunes that I just feel like, okay, I'm never going to share that with anyone, but I've never heard a bad Philippe Bruneau tune. Like, he's just, wow. All of his compositions are just And so many of them have entered the tradition. So they're tunes that people just play regularly. They get played in sessions, they get played for dancing, they get played in concerts. He really reshaped the accordion repertoire. And I was lucky enough to learn these tunes from an accordionist named Carmen Gerhard, who she lives in Montreal. We played for a fair amount of dancing together, and she knew Philippe Bruneau, the composer, personally, and there's a theme of cassette tapes in this conversation. So one of the things that Philippe moved to France at later in life and stayed in touch with certain accordionists in Quebec by making cassette tapes of himself and sending them a cassette tape. And he would make these very personalized tapes. Like, he would record himself playing tunes that he wanted that person to learn. It wasn't just, you know, I put down a few tunes, I'm going to send that tape to 10 people. It was like a tape for you of those tunes.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I feel like this is like the secret society of accordionists that I only hear about.
I had no idea cassette tapes played such a big role in the transmission of this music, which is cool.
Cassettes are, it's now not so much because we're all using MP3s.
Sure.
But yes, cassette tapes are, I think,
heroes.
Because they're cheap, they're almost indestructible, and it's so easy to record onto them. So you're not just working with commercial recordings, right? You're working with your own recordings. So anyways, Carmen learned these tunes from Philippe Bruneau, and I learned them from her. And we, when we were putting together the set for the album, me and Nicholas and Rochelle, we had a little bit of fun kind of playing around with, especially how we wanted to get into the tunes, kind of like a little introduction, and how we wanted to get out of them with those two moments in the arrangement. And we're joined on this track by a wonderful step dancer. His name is Nick Garris. He's from the United States, lives in Michigan. And you'll hear him at the beginning doing his best imitation of a scratchy 78 RPM record that's just gone on. And then you'll hear him later actually dancing.
Oh my gosh. Wait, he's doing that with his feet? Like,
with his feet. Yeah.
That's so nifty. I love that. Cool. And what, this was just my, where my mind went when I heard this piece, but does it have any like sea shanty? It reminds me of like a song you'd hear on a boat, like from, you know.
Oh.
But that's okay if it's totally not. Yeah. That's where my brain went when I heard
No,
it.
No, I love that. I don't think so, but I know what you mean. I think there's something especially about the second tune, the Hommage au Frère Pigeon, where it, it has this kind of, it's in minor and it leaps up a fifth at the beginning and has this kind of open sound. Yeah, I don't think these are related to sea shanties, but I could definitely see that connection just musically. There's kind of some melodic, melodic sensibility that feels similar.
Cool. Well, let's check it out. This is Hommage à Stéphane Landry and off of Traverse. Thank you. The third tune we are coming back to in a full circle fashion, that is Charlie Drody's tune that was also featured on the Douglastown album. And this is you guys playing it.
Yeah, this is for Traverse. I put together a set of three tunes from Douglastown. So start with the tune that I learned from Charlie's son, Ernest. It's called Eva's Tune. And well, it's called Eva's Tune because Ernest had a sister named Eva. So there's Charlie Verity, the father. And then among his children were Ernest and Eva. And what I've heard is that Eva loved this tune. So they just called it Eva's Tune. We start with Eva's Tune, and then I go into another tune from the area called Roland White's. It's from Roland White. And we end up with this tune that I learned from this reel-to-reel recording. Actually, it was, I think, a cassette transfer from a reel-to-reel that had been made in the early 60s. The cassettes come up again. Yeah, I think the original reel-to-reel was made in the early 60s, but we didn't have that. We didn't have a reel, but luckily we had a cassette copy that somebody had made of the reel. And that's what we used for the Douglastown recording. And that's where I learned this tune. And I just love it's like a kind of a quirky version. It jumps to some unexpected places. It goes to the second part of the tune, not quite when you'd expect it. Like things are a little longer or shorter than you'd expect. And it's a very like driving, powerful tune. So I love that about it too.
Cool. Let's check it out. This is my question that I like to ask guests, since the show is about explores human connection through music. And when you've talked definitely about some of the ways it does, but what do you think of your experience as a folk musician and research as a professor? How do you think traditional folk music connects us as human beings?
Thanks for that question.
Sure.
I think I'm going to spend my life working on that question. I think that's what that's what draws me to it, is how those connections work. But I guess to actually give you an answer, I think what I would say is this is a music that is meant to be done. It's meant to be played with other people. It's meant to be danced to. It's a participatory music. There are definitely concerts and festivals and like listening opportunities. That's part of the genre, especially now. And I do plenty of those myself. But when it comes down to it, this is a music that you're supposed to sit down with other people and play it, or you're supposed to dance to it, like to be physically part of it. And there's nothing I love more than sitting down with friends and playing a bunch of tunes that we all love together. And there's a way that that connects the people that I've played tunes with and felt this kind of musical connection to, even if I know very little about the rest of their lives. Like I might not know what they do for work, if they're not a lot of, maybe they're working partly as a musician or not at all, or I might not know what their family situation is, but there's this kind of connection that you feel like you both love this tune and you've played it and you've kind of connected in this groove or in this kind of flow of the music, and that stays with you. Like I can think of people I've had that experience with 20 years ago or 30 years ago that it still feels like you got to know each other in a way that is beyond words,
Absolutely.
Different than words. And that feels really powerful. I'm not sure that you can have that experience just by listening to music. You can have other really powerful, meaningful experiences listening, but it's not the same as being in it.
Yeah.
And I think this is a music that's made for that. Like it's a music that it's intended to be played with other people. So it works really well for that. And yeah, I think that's probably what I'd say to that one.
Yeah, I love that answer. It's beautiful. Well, where can people find your music, in the album Traverse, and then all follow you online and connect with you there?
I have a website, laurarisk.com. So LauraRisk.com. And you can get the album there. Well, you can get it through Bandcamp, but there's a link on my website, or you could just look me up on Bandcamp. It's also available on streaming platforms. I tend to actually post upcoming gigs more through Facebook.
Okay.
So I use my Facebook page, which is it's just like a personal Facebook page, but pretty much what I post on there is fiddle related things with a little bit of research every now and then. So I tend to post when I have an upcoming gig on Facebook as opposed to on the website, although that kind of changes depending on how much performing I'm doing at a given moment. And I think that's I'd say the website and Facebook are the way. And I do have Instagram. I'm not very good at Instagram because I feel like I'm too old for it, but
that's like
when I hang out with my teenagers. Yeah.
It's great you're on there though. I mean, I feel that way about TikTok. Like I have no knowledge of TikTok, of how to play. I actually don't even have a TikTok. So you're one step ahead in the Instagram world.
No, I don't have TikTok. I don't do TikTok. I just do. I do have Instagram, which is all at this point. Instagram is all about Traverse, the album and the band. Like when we do stuff, I post that on Instagram. Social media is a conversation we'll have another day. I think that, you know, the social media is it's like all these little mini worlds, and I am very lucky to be in the fiddling side of Facebook. So pretty much what I see on Facebook is other fiddlers and fiddle music. So it's not too bad.
Yeah. No, that's great though. And I just really, I appreciate you taking the time to be on the show and to share your background, your music, and your research with us. It's been such a pleasure and really fun to learn about, honestly.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. It's been a real pleasure for me speaking with you.
It truly was a pleasure to have Laura on the show, and I want to say a huge thank you for everyone for listening. I hope you were inspired by some of the music and stories you heard on today's program. I'll be sure to include a link to Laura's website in the episode show notes. For those of you who tuned in via the FM dial, I appreciate you listening to Home Radio 96.3 FM. And for those of you listening via podcast app or platform, thanks for choosing Travel Notes. You can subscribe and learn more about upcoming episodes on my website at gracemcnallymusic.com under the Travel Notes tab. We have some great episodes planned for the rest of the year, so keep your passport nearby. And in the meantime, wishing you peace, harmony, and smooth travels through this crazy adventure called life.